Let's get right to our top story, the expanding outbreak of the deadly coronavirus. Look at the map. What started in China has now spread to Europe, Australia, and the United States.
Here's what we know.
We have therefore made the assessment that COVID-19 can be characterized as a pandemic.
I'm officially declaring a national emergency.
Hi, I'm Jerry Ellis, and welcome back to Talking Apes for part two of my conversation with science writer David Quammen, author of Breathless, The Scientific Race to Defeat a Deadly Virus. In part one, we focused on disease ecology and David's milestone book, Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic. In that conversation, we explored the how, where, and why of zoonotic diseases, such as HIV, Ebola, and SARS, and how all the warning signs were there for the next human pandemic, COVID-19. If you haven't heard that conversation, I highly recommend checking it out first, as David lays down some of the fundamental groundwork for understanding disease concepts, such as reservoir host, spillover, and what factors trigger an emerging pandemic. In this episode, David helps us understand the nature of viruses, and specifically the highly infectious coronaviruses, and why they should be at the top of our list to understand, identify their host reservoirs, and be prepared to mitigate their impact for the survival of all apes like us. As a footnote, on the morning we are preparing to record this episode, WHO, the World Health Organization, announced COVID still an emergency 3 years after becoming a pandemic, further saying we were dangerously unprepared for another pandemic. While we may be near an inflection point where higher immunity means fewer deaths, in the week before recording this podcast, 170,000 people died in connection with COVID. You're listening to Talking Apes, the podcast that gets to the heart of what's happening with and to apes like us. Talking Apes is made possible through generous support from listeners like you and through our Patreon members program. If you'd like to support Talking Apes, you can do so by visiting our website at talkingapes.org and check on all the options for how you can help ensure a future for the kind of conversation you hear on Talking Apes. With SARS-CoV-2 very much in our lives, here's my continuing conversation with the author of Breathless, The Scientific Race to Defeat a Deadly Virus, David Quammen. Hi, David. Welcome back to Talking Apes. I'm looking forward to digging into this part two, because it feels like, as we were talking about in part one of this conversation, spillover really predicted the whole pandemic and whole COVID-19 outbreak. And many people have said that, you know, you were sort of future casting the disaster that would come. But if you read it carefully, it feels like you were just listening to a lot of amazing scientists who knew this all along.
That's right. Yeah. 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 Thanks, Jerry. It's good to be back with you. And that's absolutely right. Yeah. People have said, you know, how did you know? Why were you prescient? I wasn't prescient. I was just listening attentively to these scientists. And they were saying things that were based on context and breadth and depth of knowledge. You know, if you've got a forest of fir trees and you have a drought for 20 years and you have lightning storms, doesn't take Nostradamus to predict a fire.
Absolutely. All right. Yeah.
So that's what this was.
Well, I thought it was, but it's also interesting that in spillover, you were talking about the next big outbreak might be viral, but in particular, it might be an RNA virus such as coronavirus.
That's right.
Why coronaviruses? I want to take a minute to talk about viruses in general, so we can kind of catch people up, because I think there's a lot of lack of science understanding about what viruses really are.
Yes.
And I mean, you describe them at one point, you say they're the dark angels of evolution, terrific and terrible. but without which the immense biological diversity gracing our planet would collapse like a beautiful wooden house with every nail abruptly removed.
Yes, let me run through that just very concisely and let people know what I was talking about with this dark angels of evolution and terrific and terrible. First of all, most people have no reason really to understand what viruses are, how they work, and where they came from. But it helps to understand all this if you know a little bit about that. First of all, viruses are not cellular creatures. They do not have internal metabolisms. A virus, individual virus particle, is just a protein capsule with a genome inside. And the genome contains instructions by which that virus can replicate itself, but it can only replicate itself if it infects a living cell of a cellular creature. Cellular creatures, animals, plants, fungi, bacteria, they're all cellular. Viruses are not cellular. They're just genetic parasites. So there's this protein capsule, just like a little pill capsule or a sphere. And inside is this genome of instructions. And the genome is made of one of the two main types of genetic molecule, DNA or RNA. DNA is the famous double helix. This molecule of two strands that are linked together with sort of crossbars or steps like a double spiral staircase. And it tends to be a stable molecule. And when it has proofreading capacity, so that when it replicates itself, it corrects its mistakes. It doesn't make many mistakes. What do I mean by mistakes? That's taking one of the four letters of the DNA alphabet and substituting in the wrong letter at that particular point. An RNA genome is generally, RNA is a single-stranded molecule. It also is composed of four different letters repeating themselves in various different combinations, and those letters represent molecular units. And if it's replicating itself to create more viral particles, it's prone to making mistakes, substituting in the wrong letter here or there or at another place. And those are what we call mutations. These random mistakes in copying oneself that generates a difference between a parent strand and an offspring strand. Maybe in the coronavirus genome, for instance, there are 30,000 letters. And when a strand of the COVID coronavirus copies itself, it might make a mistake or two or three among those 30,000 letters. And those introduce differences between the two strands. RNA viruses generally make more mistakes when they copy themselves than DNA viruses. Therefore, they have more genetic variation, they're changing more, and therefore they're capable of faster evolution, of adaptation to new situations. The mistakes, the mutations, are all essentially random, but Darwinian theory of evolution by natural selection is that you take genetic variation and you... Hang on, Demelza. I feel like I'm getting too deeply in the weeds here. Yeah, this stuff is all second nature.
No, I can edit, so don't worry about it. Okay, we can work on this. I think where you're going, and I think the important piece of this is really that these changes are occurring all the time, and yes, some of them turn out to be positive, and certain of them don't go anywhere. Some of them are dead ends. Many of them are dead ends. Yeah.
These mutations, as the virus copies itself, are, as I say, essentially random, and some of them are disadvantageous, and that strain of virus just comes to a dead end. It becomes dysfunctional. Some of them are neutral and have no effect, and some of them happened to be advantageous. And then we get to Darwinian evolution by natural selection, the survival of the fittest variants. Because One particular strain of virus has a few mutations that happen to be advantageous. That strain succeeds better in copying itself and making more virus particles and possibly in transmitting from one host to another. So the bottom line on all this is that single-strand RNA viruses, because they change more as they copy themselves, have more evolvability, more capacity to adapt. And therefore, they are more dangerous as viruses that can potentially switch from one host to another, from a bat to a human, for instance, RNA viruses. So it as again, I said earlier, it does not take Nostradamus, if you're a virologist, to say that the single-stranded RNA viruses are the ones more likely to be able to switch hosts from a non-human mammal into a human. And so 15 years ago, when I was researching spillover, I talked to these scientists, including one named Don Burke, a very smart and wise virologist who at that point was dean of the University of Pittsburgh School of Public Health. And he in particular told me, well, David, yes, there's a pandemic coming. It'll likely be caused by a new virus emerging from a wild animal. That new virus most likely will be a single-stranded RNA virus because the single-stranded RNA viruses are more adaptable, more evolvable than the DNA viruses. And in particular, it's likely to be caused by a virus belonging to a group that has some history of jumping into humans. Therefore, at the top of the list stand the influenza viruses, the viruses that belong to the same family as measles, and the coronaviruses. And he told me that in 2009. So watch out for an influenza virus or a coronavirus not seen before in humans coming out of a wild animal, possibly a bat, someplace where humans have contact with wild animals, such as a live animal market in China.
Well, there's three things there I'd like to unpack a little bit. One is, first, why coronaviruses? Why are they unique in their, or why should we look at them as being unique when we're being wary about viruses out there?
In addition to what I just described, the mutation rate, the tendency to mutate frequently, that's something that they share with influenza viruses and other single-stranded RNA viruses. Coronaviruses have another capacity, another trick. And this is shared also with influenza viruses. They can swap sections, whole sections of genome from one strain of virus into another. If two strains of a particular kind of virus, say two strains of coronavirus, are infecting one bat at the same time, strain A and strain B, and they're infecting the same cell and they're replicating themselves at the same time, then sections of strain B can be combined with sections of strain A to make the new viral particle, a hybrid, that is strain C. Suddenly, strain B has added 1,000 letters of genome from strain A and comes out as not just an incrementally different virus, but a substantially different virus. Suddenly, this Cadillac, this 59 Cadillac that you've been driving, has a snowplow attached to the front of it and studded snow tires. So your 59 Cadillac now can plow through the snowy roads of Montana, pushing snow ahead of it. That's a brand new kind of virus. Coronaviruses are capable of doing that. You've got a snowplow and a Cadillac inside one cell, and out comes a hybrid that is this Cadillac with a snowplow on the front of it.
So we should be looking out for Cadillacs with snowplows.
That's the main
takeaway.
It's called SARS-CoV-2.
SARS-CoV-2. You mentioned bats in all of this, and you know, in Breathless, which we'll get to in more detail in a few minutes. In Breathless, you talk about eliminating all viruses that because that'd be a question that someone might ask, especially after this last pandemic. They might just say, why can't we just dump a lot of money into finding all these viruses and find where their hosts are and just get rid of them all? Where's the danger in that?
There is danger and there's a fallacy in that. The fallacy is that all viruses are bad. And that's just wrong. Even if you take an anthropocentric viewpoint, just you're only concerned with human health, with human success on this planet, it's a mistake to think that all viruses are bad. Viruses have played important roles in the history of evolution, triggering and brokering some major changes in the history of evolution, including the evolution of primates, including the evolution of the apes, including the evolution of the human ape. For instance, there is a kind of virus, a family of viruses called retroviruses. People have probably heard of them because HIV is a retrovirus. Retro, backward. Why is it nicknamed a sort of a backward virus? Because these particular viruses move backward in the sense of patching their genomes into the genomes of the cells that they infect. So they become part of the cells that they infect. When it's HIV, that virus infects immune cells and it patches itself into the genome of the immune cells it infects, and it might reside there dormant for a long time. And then finally, as that cell is making copies of itself, the viral stretch of genome is triggered, is turned on, and makes a lot more HIV particles, and the person has an explosion of infection with HIV. If a retrovirus infects reproductive cells in a human or any other kind of sexually reproducing creature, if it infects eggs, sperm, or the stem cells that make eggs and sperm, and patches its genome into those cells, then it becomes inherited by the offspring because it's built into those reproductive cells. That has happened a number of times in the course of the evolution of mammals, including apes and humans. One of those patches of a virus into our genome has been adapted to become a gene that is absolutely necessary to successful human pregnancy. That is a gene called syncytin 2, and it creates a membrane between the placenta and the fetus that intermediates between the growing fetus and the mother. That membrane transports nutrients from the mother to the fetus, transports waste products from the fetus back to the mother so she can excrete them. And that membrane is built by this gene that we acquired by viral infection in the course of the evolution of the mammals. That's a pretty important virus. Played an important role.
I would say that plays a very important role.
Yeah.
Especially with 8 billion of us apes on the planet, I'd say it's playing a very active role on a
That's
daily
right.
basis.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've heard the term before that we are just basically us human beings, and I guess we could apply this to all other apes and mammals. We're walking universes of viruses.
We are in two senses. We are in two senses. We have a microbiome. We have lots of microbes living in our bodies, living in our gut, living on our skin, living on our mucous membranes. We have a great diversity of bacteria, viruses, and other microbes, and they are an ecosystem. We are an ecosystem, and they balance one another. And some of them play important roles, and we need them. We need them to help digest our food. We need them to help us control the other microbes that live in us. So the microbiome is one sense in which we're composed of these other creatures. We're an ecosystem. But there's an even deeper sense, and that is these stretches of viral DNA that become part of our genome. 8% of the human genome. Not just that one gene I mentioned, syncytin 2, but 8% of the human genome is viral DNA that's been acquired by retrovirus infection over the millions and millions of years.
Wow. That's amazing. That brings me to the question of bats. You've brought it up a couple of times, and it's going to be part of a couple of things I want to talk to you about here in terms of the book, Breathless. It seems like every time one of these come up, we turn to bats. Bats keep emerging as this likely host or reservoir for diseases, and not just a coronavirus, but other diseases. And that, you know, a number of people, including you, have mentioned that horseshoe bats, for example, might be a potential host for SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19. Why bats? Why do bats continue to come up as a it's just repeated through? I mean, there are a number of other animals that pop up from time to time, but bats seem to be.
Yeah, but you're right that bats. Bats seem to be overly represented as the reservoir host, the original natural hosts of new viruses that get into humans. And that goes back through a number of the new viruses that have emerged into humans over the last 60 years. Marburg virus, which is a cousin of Ebola virus, has been traced to Egyptian tomb bats as the reservoir host. Ebola is suspected but not proven to have come from bats. Hendra virus in Australia comes out of bats, gets into horses and is amplified and then gets into humans. Nipah virus in Malaysia and Bangladesh has been traced to bats. Australian bat lyssavirus, which is closely related to rabies, obviously, is a bat virus. And there are others. So people say, why bats? And it's a terrible problem in terms of public relations for bats, because bats already have this sort of dicey reputation with people. Some people find them scary. Some people find them unappealing. They're actually magnificent, valuable creatures, wondrous, almost miraculous creatures, flying mammals. But people are concerned because they seem to be carrying more than their share of viruses of potential danger to humans. So to take that claim apart, first of all, bats are an extraordinarily diverse order of mammals. There are 1,400 different species of bat. One in every five species of mammal is a species of bat. So they're more diverse than any other mammal group, with the exception of the rodents, if I recall correctly. So yes, they seem to be overly represented, but they are overly represented in the diversity of mammals. Beyond that, there may be objective reasons why they are overly represented, why they might carry more than their share of viruses, some of which are dangerous to humans. And one of the main things the scientists point to is the fact that bats seem to have a muted immune system, a downregulated, reduced immune system. And because of that, they may carry more viruses without clearing them from their bodies, without showing symptoms, without having any sort of a battle between the virus that colonizes them and their own bodies, because they have this muted immune system. Why do they have a muted immune system? Well, because they are the only truly flying mammal, and their bodies undergo extraordinary physiological stress. That physiological stress creates circumstances, molecular circumstances, floating particles of molecule in their body that immune systems would react to. Even though those floating, you know, those free radicals, those other fragments of molecules are part of bats, they're floating free in a way that would be alarming to a fully activated, extremely alert immune system. So scientists hypothesize and are now testing the idea that bats have evolved downregulated immune systems because of their requirements, their high stress, physiologically demanding requirements of flight. And therefore, they tolerate a greater diversity of viruses than most mammals would. And therefore, they have more available in them to spill over potentially into humans.
What you were saying, it reminded me of a conversation that I had with Dr. Billy Karish, William Karish, who we mentioned in part one of our conversation and his work in the Congo. And I was asking him about bats and why bats. And one of the things that he said was really interesting to me. He said, we don't have any proof that bats don't suffer from these viruses. It's just that we're not walking through the forest picking up bat carcasses and testing them for viruses. And by the time we would get there, especially in the tropics, they would be eaten, dissolved, you know, ants and maggots and everything else would have taken them apart. And so there's just no evidence of it. But that was, and the part of the reason that conversation erupted is because of the Ebola outbreak in West Africa in 2014-15. And a bat was thought to, you know, has been traced to be, the carrier of that one, or thought
possibly.
To be
that. Possibly. Correct. But never yet proven. Yeah. Well, and Billy is a very astute guy. He's a pal of mine. I love being in the field with him. I love being in a good bar in a city with him too. He's good company, and he's
that's
right.
A whole nother podcast to Billy in a bar, but
yeah, but he's right that that's one of those things that's very hard for science to know. Yeah, when wild animals fall dead of disease in the forest, particularly a richly diverse tropical forest where there are lots of decomposers and scavengers, the evidence disappears very quickly. So we don't know how badly bats do or do not suffer from some of the viruses that they carry.
We're going to depart from bats and viruses in general and turn to the specifics of the SARS-CoV-2 outbreak, an outbreak that shook the world over the past 3 years. After this short break, to check in with assistant producer Demelza Bond. Hi, Demelza.
Hiya.
I hear you have some viral news of your own to share.
I just wanted to say a huge thanks to our listeners today. This podcast just keeps growing, and we are so proud at the time of recording this episode that we've now been downloaded in 88 countries, in 1,055 cities, by thousands of listeners. So we're absolutely over the moon, and we're so proud of what we achieve as a tiny team. Hopefully it'll just keep growing. Please spread the word, listeners. You know, tell your friends, families, anyone else who you think would enjoy it.
That is such fantastic news. Thank you, everyone, for sharing Talking Apes. Demelza, you also mentioned before we started recording today that you had received a very special email from one of our listeners.
I've been dying to read this review out because it warmed my heart so much. It's from Amanda Yonika. She's a vet from Indonesia, and she says, "Hi, Talking Apes. I listen to your podcast almost every day. It inspires me and gives me insights into many things, especially conservation. So thank you and keep on doing the great work." And this part is really amazing. She says that she just arrived in Borneo to train to become an orangutan vet. And she said, "Your podcast helped me build up my spirit to come here because I was in recovery after I broke my leg and couldn't do anything for 3 months. I was almost unable to come, and you were literally on my playlist every day during my physiotherapy. I'm finally here, more adventures to come." We are so glad that you're better, Amanda, and you made it. And we're also really pleased that the podcast, you know, cheered you up while you were bedbound. You're an absolute hero. You're out there in the field protecting orangutans. Please keep us updated on your journey. If there are any other primate professionals out there listening, come and share your stories with me too. I'd love to read them out. We are on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn, and all the links are on our website. Just one more thing, if you do enjoy this podcast, we are a non-profit, so please consider supporting us. Again, the links are on the main page of our website, and that is talkingapes.org.
Thanks, Demelza, and thank you to everyone for writing in and supporting us. And now back with David Quammen. David, I'd like to turn our focus to the new book. It's called Breathless, The Scientific Race to Defeat the Deadly Virus. Maybe we could start by describing what this book isn't. Because you mentioned that what this book is not is a medical crisis of COVID. You're not looking at the politics and the heroism of the healthcare workers and all of that. So maybe you could talk about a little bit of why you decided to make the book what it is and what it is not.
Yes. Yeah. I can do that. Partly by explaining just how the book happened, how it took shape. In early 2020, I was very busy working on a different book for my publisher, Simon & Schuster, a book about cancer as an evolutionary phenomenon. I spent the month of February 2020 in Tasmania following Tasmanian devil biologists around in the bush, because the Tasmanian devil, this marsupial carnivore that is endemic only to the island state of Tasmania, south of mainland Australia, is suffering an epidemic of genuinely contagious cancer. And there are some very revealing, interesting, dramatic things to be gleaned from that about cancer in general, that it can be a genuinely contagious disease under certain very special circumstances. Okay. I come back from that trip. March 2nd, I fly back to Montana. And I hear soon from my agent and my publisher saying, David, this pandemic, this virus now in Wuhan, China, has spread, is turning into a pandemic, and we want a book on the pandemic. And we think because of spillover and because of some of the op-eds that you've written about emerging viruses, including one that I wrote in January of 2020 saying, hey, people, this could be it. This virus in Wuhan could be the next pandemic. I wrote that before I went to Tasmania. So I'm back and they say, because of your prior work, we think you're the one who should do a pandemic book for us. And I thought about that for, as I've said, carefully for about 5 seconds, and then said yes, because I realized this was essentially a duty and this situation was going to be sucking all the air out of the room and I should be on it. So they gave me a new contract for this book. So they said, push the cancer book to the back of your desk. We'll give you a brand new contract. And the deadline will be December 31st, 2021. A year and a half I had to work on this book to research it and write it. So now I have this problem. I have committed to this book, and there are two particular problems that I realized I faced. First of all, I couldn't travel. I knew I couldn't travel. And as you've said, Jerry, my usual operating procedure includes, as a first principle, go there. If you're going to write about gorillas suffering from Ebola in the Congo, go there with Billy Karish and watch his work. If you're going to write about bats and viruses and caves of southern China, go there and climb through those caves with people studying those bats. Okay. That spillover is filled with that sort of thing. My other books, nonfiction books, are filled with that sort of thing. I realized I couldn't do that this time. I was not going to be able to get on a plane for Wuhan, China anytime soon. I was not going to get on a plane for anywhere anytime soon. This now is, you know, April and May of 2020. So that was the first problem. The second was I knew there were going to be a lot of books about the pandemic, and I had to figure out a way to write one that had some unique value that was distinct from the others. So I thought about those problems for the rest of 2020. The first thing I did was what anybody would do if they were facing these two problems of how to write this book and couldn't quite see the way around them. I scheduled myself for double knee replacement surgery. So in the summer of 2020, I got two brand new titanium knees because my knees were shot. I could hardly walk. I continued thinking about those problems, and I did a few pieces for the New Yorker magazine on the fringe of the of COVID-19. And then at the very end of 2020, I got the idea of what I was going to do, how I was going to solve those two problems. First of all, I would make the virus itself my main character. I would write a book about the origins and evolution of this virus and its fierce journey through the human population, and about the scientists who study it. And I would write about the, not just the work and the thought of those scientists, but to some degree about their lives during the pandemic, their lives as laboratory leaders, as teachers, as spouses, as parents of young children, maybe as children of elderly parents, these scientists. And I would contact, at first I said to myself, 60 or 70 of the world's leading experts, virologists, evolutionary biologists, epidemiologists, public health people, mostly scientists. And I would ask them to let me interview them by Zoom for 90 minutes and tolerate me asking them about their work and their thoughts about the virus, but also to some extent about their lives. So essentially on January 1st of 2021, I started doing that, started emailing people, some of whom I was acquainted with, some of whom I just knew of, some of whom I found, I identified them by researching. Oh, this looks like an interesting person. Here's an important person. And eventually I interviewed 95 such people. I called them my Greek chorus, 95 experts ranging from Tony Fauci and George Gao, who was director general of the Chinese CDC, and Eddie Holmes, a brilliant evolutionary virologist in Sydney, Australia, and Christian Anderson at the Scripps Institute, and also some people who were embracing the lab leak hypothesis, or who were saying that it needed careful consideration. Some of the critical voices, I interviewed some of those folks too. Eventually 95 of them, and I got the interviews all transcribed and piled them up on my desk. And that took me until June of 2021. And then I started writing and just used those interviews, those transcripts, those voices, as well as all the research that I did reading scientific journal articles and staying current with the breaking news generally about the SARS-CoV-2 virus. I used that material to tell the story of this virus from our first identification of something going on in Wuhan, China, that was causing a cluster of respiratory illnesses, sending people to hospitals in Wuhan, to the point when I had to stop writing, which was basically December of 2021. And the latest new thing at that point was the emergence of the Omicron variant. And I told the story as a scientific narrative that explored not just what science was saying about this virus, but how science works, how science is done, what science is.
Well, that's what I find really fascinating about the book is, first of all, I was completely captured by the whole opening. I mean, the way you present it, that whole sort of clock ticking starting on the 29th of December or 30th of December on New Year's Eve, and then proceeding over the next several days as these insanely bright people who understand all of this begin to break this down and see this information coming out of China. And it's being shared around the world. And I think that's a really important factor to maybe, if you could talk about a little bit, is that we were, I think, as the public, and partly this was due, and I don't want to get too deep into the politics, but partly due because politicians were just not, most politicians don't have much science background, and they also weren't sharing it, the information, I think, in real enough time that we knew a lot more than was being shared at the time. And those who did know, they could see the writing on the wall very quickly, it seemed like, based on the opening of the book. Maybe you could walk us through that, because I think people think we didn't know. And you know, there's always, as you've addressed in other formats, I mean, the reason it's called COVID-19 is because it broke out in 2019. So there was some time in which this was occurring and that information was starting to be shared.
Yes.
Maybe you could talk about that just a little bit what we know and what we don't know.
Right. I trace that. The book is divided into a number of, into about eight longish chapters, titled chapters. But within each chapter are short, relatively short numbered sections. And those lead from one to the other, two to three to four to five. And I did want this to have narrative momentum to be. I wanted people to hear the tick of the clock. And I had asked all these 95 people, virtually all of them at least, how did you first hear about this? That was one of the questions I asked, one of my lines of inquiry. How did you first hear about this virus in Wuhan, China? And what did you hear? And what did you think? And so I took the voices one by one that seemed most able to tell me what was going on when. I started with a Chinese-born scientist named Henry Yi's Li, who was working on coronaviruses in a lab at the University of Pennsylvania under a woman named Susan Weiss, a longtime coronavirus expert. She'd been studying coronaviruses for 40 years, during which time it was a very unfashionable field of study. And she was one of the leading experts. Henry Li was her postdoc. I talked with her, interviewed her, and then she said, you should talk with Henry Li, my postdoc, because he was hearing about this from his friends back in Shanghai in mid-December of 2019. So I interviewed Henry Li, and he told me he communicates with friends back in China by the app known as WeChat. It's a phone social media app. And he started hearing from friends back in China in mid-December, hey, there's something going on. There's a respiratory outbreak that is sending people to the hospitals in Wuhan. Nobody knows what it is. It could be transmissible from human to human. It could be serious. So I got Henry Li's very early impressions of that. And then I described what Susan Weiss thought about that when Henry Li reported it to her. And she said, well, first thing we need to do is order lots of PPE, lots of masks and gloves and some more protective equipment, because we're going to be dealing with this new virus and it sounds like it could be dangerous. And then word starts to leak that this new virus is a coronavirus. That's the point when Susan Weiss said, you know, we're going to be working on this. So let's gear up. I spoke with a woman named Marjorie Pollack, who is deputy editor of an internet alert service on infectious diseases called ProMedMail. She was working, and ProMedMail has 80,000 subscribers around the world, including me. I've subscribed to it for about 20 years. And we get emails, sometimes 10 or 12 a day, alerting us to different infectious disease events around the world. That's the purpose it serves. Early, early, early warning. If an otter dies of avian flu in England, we get an email. If a child suffers a case of Nipah virus in Bangladesh, we get an email. So Marjorie Pollack, on the night of December 30th, is alerted by one of her sources that something is going on in Wuhan, China. There's a cluster of respiratory cases that seem to be related. And so she scours the web. She sits at her computer the night of December 30th. She's looking for a second source. She finally finds a second source. There's a translated alert that's been issued by the Wuhan Municipal Health Commission, and finds out that, yes, there is concern that this is caused by a virus and it could be transmissible from human to human. She writes an alert, posts it on ProMedMail. It goes to 80,000 subscribers, including me, and bells start to ring around the world. And then there are a couple of teams of scientists, including Eddie Holmes in Sydney, Australia, is part of, and they are sequencing samples of the virus. And they're seeing that this virus is not only a coronavirus, but it's a SARS-like coronavirus. It's similar to the 2003 SARS virus that emerged from southern China. It was a very dangerous respiratory outbreak and killed one person in 10 that it infected. But it was not terribly transmissible. It was not transmissible from asymptomatic cases. So we managed to contain it. But that similarity to SARS, the original SARS, caused great concern. Eddie Holmes and his colleague Yongzhen Zhang in Shanghai. We're working on interpreting the genome as soon as they got it sequenced. And Eddie is telling Zhang, look, we have to post this genome publicly. We have to release this to the world. We have to do this right now. This is a conversation they're having by phone between Sydney and Shanghai. And eventually Eddie persuades Zhang, at some risk to Zhang's freedom and career, to release the genome sequence on a website, an open website. So the genome sequence goes up the morning of January 11th, Shanghai time, evening of January 10th, Washington time, and suddenly the whole world has the genome, the 30,000 letters of code of this virus, and can start to draw conclusions about how dangerous this virus is, where it may have come from, and how it's likely to work. So I'm describing that, you know, hour by hour over the course of few dozen pages in the course of the first couple of weeks.
I guess, and that's what I loved about it. It really is like this whodunit thriller. You want to know what the next minute is, and it would make a brilliant movie. I hope somebody's bought the movie rights to it, and you become a multi-bazillionaire off of it, because it really, it's an amazing story. And if yeah, there's huge tragedy as we now, you know, in retrospect, we look back and we see the millions that have died and the economies that have been turned over and just the disruption of life in general. But what I find fascinating is that you're describing this, and yet it's 3 months later. As you said, you flew back from Tasmania on the 2nd of March, or talked to your publisher on the 2nd of March. So we're into March before the world sort of recognizes this as a pandemic. And it, from a science standpoint, it felt like 3 months earlier, the alarm bells were going off.
The alarm bells were going off, yes. And anyone who was versed in this subject could hear those alarm bells ringing loudly in January. I mentioned that I wrote an op-ed before I went to Tasmania. I got an email from an op-ed editor at the New York Times. She was based in Hong Kong by chance. And she said, Kwaman, isn't it time for you to do an op-ed for us again? I do them occasionally for the Times. And so she was just checking in with me and saying, it'd be nice to have an op-ed if something seems to you worthy of the attention. Oh, for instance, maybe that new virus in Wuhan, China. And I said, yes, I definitely would like to do an op-ed, and definitely on that virus in Wuhan, China. So this is the middle of January 2020. I knew what the scientists were saying and what they had said. I wrote an op-ed saying this new virus in Wuhan, this has pandemic potential. This could be the next big one. This could kill millions of people. That went up on January 28th. And then I got on a plane and went to Tasmania. And I'm staying at a hotel in Tasmania, hanging out with Tasmanian devil biologists. But every time I go back to my hotel room, I've got 10 more emails from around the world saying, hey, can we interview you about this Wuhan thing? China television and Russia television and CNN and Australian Broadcasting Corporation and others. So I spent half my time in Tasmania doing sort of a remote press tour on the subject of this virus that was beginning to be a pandemic virus. But the scientists were all aware of this too. The scientists that I knew, I was only channeling what they were saying. I just happened to be plugged into the right scientists.
We will put a link to that article that was published on January 28th in the New York Times. I think that article, it really stunned me. And I have to admit that I didn't read it on January 28th. I wish I had. The opening line of it, I don't know if you remember, but he said, the latest scary new virus that has captured the world's horrified attention. That's what I find so fascinating, is that you have written this and it's published on January 28th. And yet, all of February, we have people who are still stumbling around trying to come to grips with, oh yeah, it could be out there. It could come here. It could come to Europe. It could come to the US. It could spread around the planet. I mean, they literally feels like they're stumbling.
The governmental response and the public health response, as it can be summoned by political leaders, was just not there. It was just horrible. And that was the thing. People have asked me, what surprised you most about the emergence of this pandemic? And what surprised me most is that governments did not respond to it. When I went to Tasmania, I think I flew down there on February 7th. I put some masks into my briefcase because I thought by the time I come home, it may very well be mandatory to wear a mask on an airplane. And when I flew home on March 2nd, no, it was not. And I also thought that there would be airport screening, not just screening for, do you have a temperature? Do you have a fever? Which is very simple to do and was done during the first SARS outbreak. If you flew into, for instance, Australia during 2003, as you got off the plane, you were screened to see if you had a fever because of the concern about SARS-1. There was none of that going on. A scientist had told me 10 years earlier that he was working on a particular kind of portable technology, a chip reader that would be capable of screening for multiple different viruses in real time, in the time that it took for a person to pass through airport security, so that you would swab a person and then the person would, you know, take off your shoes, take off your belt, put them on the tray, take out your computer, put it in the bin, send it through, walk through the x-ray machine, come out the other side. And by that time, they would have taken your swab and put it in this portable machine and they would know whether you were carrying this new virus. I expected that when I flew back from Tasmania. It wasn't there. It did not exist yet because that scientist had been unable to get funding support to develop it.
I went to China in 2003 and looking back on it, I was a bit naive. SARS had broken out. But you were still able to get into China. And I had been working in Wulong, where the giant panda reserve is. And I went in, I remember passing through Shanghai Airport, and there was no one there, of course, because everything was in kind of lockdown. And they were taking your temperature. You were walking through what we now know is sort of, you know, body scanners for metal detection and things. But they were scanning your whole body thermally. They were on it so fast. And yet that was not an asymptomatic coronavirus, which is, you know, at the core, you've mentioned in things, and is at the core of why that one didn't spread.
Right.
Because my impression is that virologists and others think that was the worst, 2002, 2003, but that one could have been the worst.
Scientists that I talked to, and I quote one of them, Ali Khan, who was a deputy head of the special pathogens group at CDC when I first met him back in 2006 or 2007, he told me that SARS, the original SARS in 2003, was the scariest viral outbreak he had ever worked on. And he'd worked on Ebola outbreaks and other dangerous virus outbreaks. He said, no, SARS was the scariest because it was respiratory and because it was so deadly, killing 1 in 10. And if that had been transmissible from asymptomatic cases, he told me in 2006, that would have been a nightmare scenario. We were very lucky to stop it with only 8,000 cases and 800 deaths. We dodged a bullet, he told me. And other people use the same phrase, dodging a bullet. What we've realized more and more over time is that these bullets are flying past our head all the time. We're constantly walking through a hail of bullets, such as SARS-1 and SARS-2. SARS-2 happened to be a bullet that hit us square in the chest. One of the tragedies of this whole situation is that so little was done between 2003 and 2019 to put into place pandemic protections based on what science knew, just utterly inadequate.
Well, that's what I find fascinating. I mean, we have a 20-year gap, basically, between 2003 and where we sit now. And halfway between that, you come out with a book called Spillover, which talks about all of this. It wasn't like this. That's public. The book was published and it's public talking about these diseases. And yet we still seem collectively very inadequate about addressing the need to prevent these from happening. And
well, let me add one thing to that, Jerry. Let me
ahead.
Add one thing to that.
Sure.
One of the reasons I think why leaders and the public have been so slow to get on this and to spend the money and the political will necessary for preparedness is that there's always a a randomness. There's a chance, an element of chance in all this. Nothing is completely deterministic. Science can say there is a high likelihood that there will be another RNA virus new to humans spilling over from a wild animal sometime in the relatively near future. But science can't say whether it's going to be an avian influenza or another coronavirus for sure. Science can't say that it's going to be next year or the year after. Science can't say whether it's going to be on this president's watch or after he leaves office. And so it's like a roulette ball circling around on a roulette wheel. And is that roulette ball going to land on red 19? And if it does, we have a pandemic. But as time goes on and you keep spinning that wheel, it becomes more and more likely that eventually the ball will land on red 19. If you have 8 billion people around the world who are invading wild habitat and interacting with wild animals, then it's like you've taken a bag of 20 roulette balls and you've put them all on the roulette wheel, and now you've spun it. Now the odds of hitting red 19 have gone up. At a certain point, as people keep doing this, you're adding more and more balls to the roulette wheel, and it's going to land on red 19, and the whole casino is going to explode. At a certain point, you want to leave the building, or you want to do something to prevent that wheel from continuing to spin with so many roulette balls on it.
That's as you were describing it, my head was going to, yeah, we're just throwing balls onto that thing and it's gonna happen. So we don't run out of time. I want to jump to a couple of quick things. One is, you wrote in Breathless, we will probably never know the origin of the pandemic, because and I don't want to get into that debate necessarily. There's a lot of, you know, back and forth between, was it human caused and released from the lab, and were they doing these nefarious things about messing with viruses and creating some kind of, you know, virus that will infect the planet kind of stuff by the Chinese, versus did it come from an animal and, as you know, spill over from an animal source? And you said, we will probably never know the origin of the pandemic, the loss of animal samples in the wet market in Hunan. First of all, could you just quickly describe what a wet market is and looks like? Because you've got I know you have beautiful, wonderful firsthand knowledge of that and have described it in the past.
Well, a so-called wet market is a big area under a roof with stalls, trading stalls, selling different things, like your farmer's market in the summer. It's called wet because there's a lot of water and blood in a market that's selling selling seafood, selling vegetables, selling some very wholesome things, and also selling domestic animals for food, selling poultry, live poultry, selling pigs, selling snakes, selling wild animals of all sort live for food. That's what a classic Chinese wet market looks like. And people go there for fresh food. But the wild animals bring a special kind of risk to that sort of situation, because all wild animals carry their own viruses. When humans have close contact with wild animals, it gives the virus an opportunity to spill from one host into another. The Huanan Seafood Wholesale Market, as it's known, translated into English, in Wuhan, where many of the first cases were located, and where most or all of the first cases were centered around geographically, contained a lot of wild animals for sale live for food. Some of them bred and raised in captivity, although with wild species, and others captured from the wild, showing trap injuries, showing bullet injuries. Raccoon dogs, bamboo rats, porcupines, palm civets, no bats, live bats in that market in December of 2019, as far as we know. But all of that traffic in wild animals from other parts of Hubei province or other parts of China involves the risk not just of transporting animals that are carrying viruses, but of mixing those viruses You know, you load a bunch of wild animals into cages and put them on a truck and drive them to the city of Wuhan. And they're going to be sharing viruses. They're going to be defecating and urinating on one another and breathing on one another. And viruses are going to pass from one kind of wild animal to another with the chance that eventually that particular virus or a recombined strain of a new virus that's the mix of two other viruses might get into humans. But on January 1st of 2020, Chinese officialdom decreed that that market had to be closed and cleaned, sterilized. And the vendors were all run out of there. They took away some of their equipment, had to leave some behind. They took away their animals. And then after this closure and cleaning had begun, teams of scientists went in to sample looking for traces of that virus. But And I said, we'll probably never know the exact animal this came from because all of that evidence was destroyed on January 1st, 2020.
So it's kind of like wiping out a crime scene before you have a chance to figure out the crime. Yeah. You mentioned avian flu. And you know, part of the reason that we're having this conversation on Talking Apes is that, as we talked about in part one of this conversation, the bushmeat trade is huge, and that's why I wanted you to explain wet markets. And as we look across the planet, not just southern China and not just Southeast Asia, are wet markets big, but you know, they're across equatorial Africa and other places, Borneo and others, are these markets, and these diseases are out there, and a lot of the animals that are being traded are primates. You talk about the fact that, it towards the end of Breathless, you talk about the fact that trying to find the quote here. You say COVID-19 won't be our last pandemic of the 21st century. It probably won't be our worst. And that's how you sort of leave us hanging. And then just a few days ago, I was reading an article in the New York Times, an opinion piece in there. The next pandemic could be deadlier. And that one all focused on H5N1, which is the avian influenza, or commonly known as bird flu. And you mentioned bird flu a minute ago. And then you actually mentioned it even earlier with otters dying off in England from it. And that's, I wanted to ask you about that because you wrote, this is, I thought was funny, I'll say in a strange way. You wrote, you write that virologists had for decades seen such an event coming, like a small dark dot on the horizon of Western Nebraska rumbling towards us at indeterminable speed with indeterminable force, like a runaway chicken truck. I just find it, I guess, ironic that you mentioned chicken truck. And now the avian flu we're starting to see it move across. In Spain, there's an outbreak in mink farms.
Right. Well, and the full quote is, I say, like a runaway chicken truck or an 18-wheeler loaded with rolled steel.
Exactly. I want to make
clear that there's a sort of a rattly, ramshackle randomness to this situation, but there's also this driving, powerful set of potential consequences. But with the chicken, yeah, the mention of chickens was no accident. And partly always, I have bird flu in mind, because it is circling the planet now in wild birds and in domestic birds, H5N1, avian influenza. I wrote an op-ed about that back in October for the New York Times. There was that piece by, I think her name, would butcher.
Zeynep
Tufekci.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
So her piece, that was a good piece too. People are watching that, this avian influenza, because with a few mutations or a reassortment of a genome, it could turn into a virus that's not only capable of infecting mammals and the occasional human, but perhaps transmitting from one human to another. And that could be very, very bad. The scientists I trust are also saying that, yes, it could be avian influenza, and we need to watch that, but it's not just a matter of avian influenza. There are these other viruses out there that could also be the next one. We need to not forget that. But avian influenza in particular is the one that has been identified now as so widespread among birds on the planet that it's getting lots of chances to evolve, lots of chances to mutate, lots of chances to reassort. Influenzas, you call it reassorting rather than recombining, but it's a similar thing, swapping sections. So if, for instance, a poultry worker in Oklahoma was suffering from a case of seasonal flu, ordinary influenza, and he was working with chickens, and some of those chickens were carrying H5N1, it's possible that he could become infected simultaneously with H5N1 and ordinary human seasonal influenza, and that those two viruses could reassort in him, and out would come a hybrid virus that would contain the worst and most dangerous elements of avian flu and the elements of seasonal influenza that made it very transmissible among humans. That's a nightmare scenario, but it's not the only nightmare scenario.
Do you take different precautions now as you travel? Because, you know, I know that you've been going into caves in southern China and into wet markets. Do you think about those in a different way?
I'm going back to wearing masks on airplanes when I do fly on airplanes, which I stopped doing for a few months. But now with the evolution of Omicron and its capacity for immune escape, I'm starting to get concerned about that again. And what I hear about, you know, I've had 5 shots of vaccine plus a case of COVID, but I'm reading scientific studies that say I should not assume that that means I can't catch it again, and that it's possible that I could get long COVID or some other serious adverse effects from a second infection. But I'm worried about other people, too. I'm feeling like we all need to realize that this pandemic is not over. In terms of the other threats, in terms of going into caves with scientists looking for bats carrying viruses and going into the jungles and things like that, I'm getting a little old and rickety for some of that activity, even with my new titanium knees. But I would do that again. I would take sensible precautions. But if I had the opportunity to write about some of that research, I would seize the opportunity of doing that firsthand, if possible, on the scene. And those risks, I've always been careful. You know, stand behind the scientists, 3 feet behind them, with your notebook in your hands. Don't let them hand you a clawing, biting, giant fruit bat if you can help it, or a hypodermic syringe, and otherwise just take whatever precautions they're taking.
Before I let you go, I want to ask about the cancer book. Are you going to get back to it? Have you gotten back to it?
I haven't gotten back to it yet. I've got another book coming out in May, a book about wildlife and wild places around the planet, called The Heartbeat of the Wild. It's a collection. It's a collection of 21 pieces I wrote for National Geographic over 20 years, but revised with new connective tissue, updated with an overview and made into, I hope, a cohesive book. And after I've finished with the chores of helping to launch that and promote it a little bit, then I will get back to the cancer as an evolutionary phenomenon book.
David, you mentioned earlier that you asked the scientists to tolerate you for 90 minutes. I want to thank you for tolerating me and us for we're almost at 90 minutes on this part two. So it's been a few hours in total. I want to thank you so much. I know how jammed your schedule is with everything and plus just doing your own writing. So I really appreciate you spending some time with us on Talking Apes and about this.
I have enjoyed it very much, Jerry. I really appreciate the depth of your your interest and your reflection on this. And it's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Great. Well, take care. And let's when the other books come out, let's get a chance to get back together and talk about them.
Sounds good. Sounds good to me. All right.
I want to thank David Quammen for this journey into the science of disease ecology, spillover, and the deadly COVID-19 pandemic of the past 3 years through his most recent book, Breathless, The Scientific Race to Defeat a Deadly Virus. You'll find a link to part one of our conversation, as well as additional information and links to everything David and I were discussing, including David's articles in the New York Times, on our website at talkingapes.org. That's talkingapes.org. You've been listening to Talking Apes, the podcast that gets to the heart of what's happening with and to apes like us. Our conversations are with folks from across this planet of apes, writers, researchers, conservationists, and scientists, all getting us closer to understanding who we are and why. Because ensuring the survival of the other four great apes is the only way to ensure our own. Huge thanks to our amazing Talking Apes team, assistant producer Damel Zaban and lead researcher Megan Lewandowski, for all the behind-the-scenes work they do in making this podcast possible. And I would also like to thank you, the donors and Patreon members who make Talking Apes successful through your generous support and the sharing of this podcast. If you appreciate what you hear on Talking Apes, consider supporting us by visiting our website at talkingapes.org. And finally, I would like to thank all of those on the front lines of great ape survival. We hope through Talking Apes we're shining a light on the incredible, selfless work that you do every single day to ensure great apes, primates, and their forest homes survive and thrive well into the future. I'm Jerry Ellis. Thanks for listening to and sharing the Talking Apes podcast.